Hello, and welcome to an update on the changing employment laws in the DMV webinar presented by Pulcinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 support email. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the Resources tab located next to the. If you experience any technical difficulties or would like to ask our speakers questions, please type your question in the technical support box. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pulcinelli shareholder Connie Bertram.
Thank you so much for that introduction. As Emma mentioned, we have a fabulous resource page for COVID-19 issues. This is not a COVID-specific program, although we will talk a little bit about some of the state law developments in the DMV with respect to COVID-19 at the end of the program. But we wanted to, since we're all dealing with all of these issues right now, as employees start returning to work and employers are grappling with changes in their workforce, it is an excellent resource for employers. This will also be posted on our Pulcinelli at Work blog, which also has resources for specifically for employers. We have a fabulous panel here today with almost 50 years of combined experience in the Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. And I've been litigating in Virginia and then Maryland and D.C. now for 30 years, I'm proud to say. And as you'll hear, there have been a lot of changes in the employment laws. To my right is Tony Terrain. He's our newest shareholder in the Labor and Employment Department. He joined us on March 30th, and so with our office closing, we haven't seen each other as much as we should, but he is having a great time integrating into the firm. And then to my left is Jack Bloom, who's been working with me in the D.C. office over the last 2 years and is a fabulous resource in all three jurisdictions. I want to jump right into the program, because we have a lot of content to cover. Interestingly, Virginia has been the big source of new statutes over the last several months. I am a near lifelong resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the one thing you could count on until recently was conservatism with respect to employment laws. The laws were probably some of the more employer-friendly in the country. The judges were very conservative, and the juries tended to be very conservative. The whole world has changed dramatically in Virginia. We now have the Democrats in charge of the legislature. We have a lot of recent appointees, particularly to the Fourth Circuit, that have changed the landscape of employment law. And then recently, we have some statutory changes in Virginia. We also have changes we want to discuss with you both in Maryland and the District of Columbia, which have been historically, at least recently, more employee-friendly as well. As I mentioned, Virginia has been traditionally a employer-friendly jurisdiction, and what we've seen now is really a major shift. We're going from basically no claim, for wage violations, overtime violations and such, and essentially no claim for any type of discrimination, harassment, or retaliation, and no whistleblower statute. And as we're going to talk about, all of that has changed over the last several months. And I'm having trouble with the. And I want to turn it first over to Tony to lead us in talking about the Virginia Values Act, which is a seismic change.
Yes, as Connie mentioned, it's a huge shift from employer-friendly provisions and laws to employee-friendly provisions and laws. Specifically, the Virginia Values Act, which becomes effective next month, expands the Virginia Human Rights Act. So in addition to race, color, religion, and those already protected classes, the Virginia Values Act now includes sexual orientation, gender identity, and veteran status. In addition to expanding the class of protected categories, it also changes the damages available to successful plaintiffs. Under the prior Virginia Human Rights Act, the successful plaintiffs could only recover up to a year of back pay. There was no punitive damages or reinstatement, and attorney's fees was limited to 25% of the back pay award. Now, there's no limits on punitive or compensatory damages. Successful employees can get punitive damages and reinstatement, and there's no limit on the attorney's fees. Now, specifically with gender identity is defined as gender-related identity, appearance, or other gender-related characteristics without regard to the person's assigned gender at birth. So essentially, it's how the employee views their gender themselves. Practically, what employers need to take away from this is they might maybe uniform requirements that you have for your employees, or certain job duties that you may be inclined to give to one sex or another. Now all that has to go out the window, and there has to be a holistic assessment as to how the employee views themselves and accommodation of that identity. Sexual orientation is a little bit more of an easier battle to deal with, because if somebody comes out and says, you know, they're gay, or they, you know, have a husband or a wife, we know you can't discriminate against them. But gender identity is a little different because it's a little bit more nuanced, and I think it's important for employers to review their policies, train their managers in terms of what, essentially a gender identity means and how we can avoid discriminating against individuals who may not identify with the gender they were assigned at birth.
And I think it's important for employers to understand the impact that this statute is going to have on litigation in Virginia. For many years since I've been practicing, employees were basically left with either a claim under federal statute, or for very small employers who did not have enough employees to be subject to the federal laws, they could bring an act under the Virginia Human Rights Act that was extremely limited, as Tony described. Now, as we see in D.C., I think it's going to be likely that the plaintiff's attorneys and the plaintiffs are going to be bringing suit in state court in Virginia, where there aren't as many limitations on discovery, but there is not a traditional mechanism for summary judgment. So an employer could be facing a situation where they have to respond to innumerable interrogatories and document requests, undertake extensive discovery, and then on summary judgment, the way the mechanism works, you cannot rely on deposition testimony to try to get summary judgment, which is how many employment cases, or most employment cases, are won that don't settle. And you can only rely on requests for admission. And it's awkward and hard to get summary judgment in that kind of situation. So let's move on. And Zach's going to talk about the next development in Virginia law, which is the new Wage Payment Act.
Yeah, so this is another major change in Virginia. Before this year, there was really no private claim for employees to bring for the non-payment of their wages in Virginia. They had the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, which applies to minimum wages and overtime, but doesn't really regulate what happens beyond, beyond that. Or they could file a claim with the state, which the state could choose to investigate or could do nothing about. Or they could bring a claim for in court for breach of contract, which is a pretty limited remedy. It basically would allow the employee to recover the amount of wages that they claim were due, but wouldn't make any allowance for their attorney's fees or other charges. So those amounts would really come off the top of the employee's recovery and limit the attractiveness of that claim. Now employees in Virginia will be able to bring a wage payment claim that's similar to the claims that were already available in Maryland and D.C., and they can recover up to three times the amount of the unpaid wages, as well as 8% interest and potentially their reasonable attorney's fees. So this really gives a lot more leverage to employees in dealing with these types of wage disputes in Virginia, and it could really increase the amount of wage and hour litigation that we're going to see in the Commonwealth. One important factor there is that the Wage Payment Act uses the Fair Labor Standards Act's collective action standards for group claims rather than the traditional class action standard, which the collective action standard is typically easier for employees to meet and certify a group claim. So we could see more claims of larger groups of employees kind of banding together to seek redress for wage payment issues that are small, are relatively small as to any particular employee.
So I want to talk about the next, the kind of the third major claim that's new in Virginia. You know, Virginia, in its traditional conservative way, had no prior statute that provided whistleblower rights to employees of private companies. They could assert a claim for wrongful discharge and violation of public policy, which is called a Bowman claim. In Virginia, and was limited to situations where an employee was terminated as a consequence of complaining about actions that went to public policies that were encapsulated in Virginia statutes. And as you can imagine, there was extensive litigation about what qualified as a public policy, what constituted a statute. It was a very, very restricted, hard to litigate claim. This is all just kind of busted loose now with the whistleblower retaliation claim. And essentially, a employee can assert a claim if they feel that they've been retaliated against for reporting violations of any federal or state law to a supervisor, governmental body, or law enforcement official. It also protects employees who participate in, testify in, provide information in connection with federal or state investigative proceedings. Employees who prevail are entitled potentially to injunctive relief, back and front pay, and to reasonable attorney's fees. And this is going to go in effect also next month on July 1st. This is a very broad retaliation provision, even when you compare it to some of the more liberal states around the country, the more employee-friendly states. There's a very broad definition of retaliation that's consistent with federal law, so it doesn't just protect terminations, but also other types of retaliatory acts. And it's also very broad when compared to the other federal and state statutes because, number one, it does not require employees to report internally before they proceed, unlike some of the federal statutes. Number two, it's not, and this is the most significant, it's not tied to a specific prohibited conduct. You know, for instance, if an employee is proceeding with a Sarbanes-Oxley or a Dodd-Frank claim under federal law, they'd be complaining about shareholder fraud. If they were bringing a False Claims Act claim under federal law, they'd be complaining about government abuse, waste, or government contractor, you know, fraudulent activity. In addition, they can complain to any number of individuals, including a supervisor, a governmental body, or a law enforcement official. So this becomes very very broad statute, and given the concentration of government contractors in Virginia, I think we're going to be seeing, for instance, False Claims Act coupled with Virginia whistleblower retaliation claims, adding a new dynamic to that. Like the other statutes, a very significant piece of this is that the employees, they don't have to file a charge or anything first. They can immediately go into state court if they choose, or federal court if they have some other basis for federal jurisdiction, and seek redress, trying to get an immediate injunction for reinstatement, for instance, which, as you can recognize, is very disruptive. In addition, as we talked about with these other statutes, very broad right to discovery in Virginia, and very restricted summary judgment mechanisms. So I think that employers are going to be facing a lot more trials in these cases, whether it's brought under the Whistleblower Retaliation Act, Virginia Values Act, or the new wage statute. You know, one of the consequences of Virginia being an employer-friendly for so long is there's not a very large plaintiff bar in Virginia. I think we're going to see that changed dramatically even over the next couple of months, as the plaintiff's attorneys who previously had focused on D.C. and Maryland are going to be expanding into the Commonwealth. And I think we're going to see a lot of new claims that are asserted. Let's talk about some other significant changes. And Jack's going to be talking about the new independent contractor misclassification provision in Virginia.
Yeah, so contractor misclassification has been a huge issue over recent years in a lot of other jurisdictions. And now Virginia is really belatedly joining the party. This act will kind of go hand in hand with the Wage Payment Act. Independent contractors who think they've been misclassified can already bring claims for overtime and minimum wages and other payments under the Wage Payment Act. Now, under the Misclassification Act, they can open up a second front against the employer by complaining to the Virginia Department of Taxation, which can then investigate and impose a penalty against the employer, which ranges from $1,000 per employee to the first offense up to $5,000 for a third or subsequent offense. One important part of this statute that is a small victory, I suppose, to employers is that the statute uses the IRS independent contractor test rather than the stricter tests we've been seeing in places like California under the controversial AB 5 bill. So, you know, that's, I guess it's not as bad as it could be for employers, but by no means a win. One important consequence of the misclassification bill could be for businesses that rely on Virginia's state government contracts, because if a business is found to have misclassified an employee as an independent contractor, that business can be potentially debarred from obtaining Virginia state government or local government contracts for a period of 2 years. So if you're a business that really relies on those contracts, this can be a very high-stakes enactment. And it just emphasizes the need for employers to really go in and audit their independent contractor arrangements, specifically if multiple employees or independent contractors are involved, and you know, those fines could really increase due to a large number of employees.
So, Tony, let's talk about the Virginia minimum wage increases.
So, the Virginia legislature decided, because of the COVID-19 crisis, to delay the wage increases. The minimum wage is supposed to go to $9.50 this year, but they voted to delay this earlier, I want to say March or April. And so now the $9.50 increase won't take effect until March 2021. And as you can see, it will gradually increase automatically from 2021 to 2023. Now, the overall legislation has it contemplates an increase to $15 an hour. As you've seen, people who have unionized workforce or people who are involved with unions have seen they've campaigned for Fight for 15, where they want broad minimum wage to increase to $15 in most jurisdictions. It's kind of a response to that, but it won't get to 15 unless by July 1st, 2024, the Virginia legislature decides to enact the final two wage increases. So by 2026, Virginia is anticipating to go to $15 an hour as the minimum wage, but that's all contingent on the makeup of the Virginia legislature and whether the sentiment is the same as it is now with these seismic shifts.
So, Tony, with a lot of these statutes, I mean, we're in a very unique geography, right? Because we've got D.C., where we're sitting right now, and I live in Virginia, and you know, we've got Maryland. You live in Maryland. And so, you know, let's say we have an employer, and they're based in Tyson's Corner, but their employees are telecommuting from Virginia, or actually, let me change the hypothetical. Let's just say it's a Bethesda-based company, and they have employees now, as a consequence of COVID and the new norm, the employees are telecommuting from Virginia, and maybe they have employees that work, you know, in non-COVID situations, let's just say, in the pre-COVID or post-COVID, have employees who are working, meeting up with customers in a tri-geography area. How do these minimum wage statutes play out in those situations?
Yeah, so actually, the general rule, and again, there's always exceptions, but the general rule is the wage of where the employee works applies. So for telecommuting, if they spend majority of their time in Maryland, for example, working for a Virginia company, arguably the Maryland minimum wage would apply. However, there are instances where more than one minimum wage could apply because you do work in all three of the jurisdictions kind of equally. The best practice for us and the way the law is written is that you should probably give them the highest of the three minimum wages that they're eligible for. DC has a very specific rule that says if you have if you spend at least 50% of the time working in the district, then you're entitled to get that minimum wage. In this case, employees would like to get the minimum wage because the DC current minimum wage is $15 or will be $15 effective July 1st. Virginia is currently at $9.25, and as I said, it won't increase to $9.50 until next year, and Maryland's at $11. So it would be, if the employee spends more than 50% in DC, I would advise you, especially people who have operations in all three jurisdictions, to just to pay them the 15. The other alternative is if they are in fact entitled to all three minimum wages, you could apportion out how much time they spend in each of the jurisdictions, but just practically as an administrative nightmare.
That sounds like a nightmare.
Right.
and this is true for so many of these statutes where we have different standards at the federal level and then Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. I call this kind of a conflict of laws situation. You need to figure out which laws apply to your employees on an individual basis. And I think the important point here is that since our world order has changed and we're going to be using so many more telecommuting employees, this is something we got to go back as employers and audit to make certain that we're treating employees appropriately who used to be in the office and now maybe for a long time are going to be working from home.
And I would just add, just as a practice tip, anytime that there's a new change in the minimum wage, a lot of people use like paychecks or ADP for their payroll system. And, you rely on your vendor and you pay them and you hope that they get it right. But it's always good just to double check to make sure that they have complied with the new applicable law, just to make sure that you're not subject to any wage and hour litigation
right.
in the future.
Yeah, I mean, paychecks don't know that somebody's working from home for 6 months, for instance. So let's talk about the last development. I think it's the last development for Virginia. Did I skip too many? No.
And this is an interesting law. So Virginia also passed during this whole new sea change and wave of philosophical change in laws, a ban on non-competes for low-wage employees who are part of training or educational programs. So, for example, the easiest answer to us as attorneys would be summer associates. They're still in school, but they're working kind of as an internship position. The Virginia legislature has prohibited employers from entering into non-competes for them to allow them to find other jobs. And again, Virginia is generally not favorable for non-competes. They don't really view them highly if you look at the case law. So it kind of makes sense here. But what if there's an existing agreement? What if you already have an agreement with an employee who is a low-wage earner, as it's defined as an intern or student or a trainee, but what do you do? Well, that agreement may be void under the current law, but you can always enter into a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement to protect your trade secrets and other proprietary information. So the idea of the law is to allow freedom of movement for interns and training employees, but it still has the protection for the employer to protect its trade secrets and things that employers shouldn't just run off with. What about non-solicitation agreements? Well, that's not specifically addressed, but under the theory and the policy that you want to allow these type of employees to get the jobs that they want after they're out of the training program but still protect the employer's proprietary information, non-solicitation agreements would theoretically fall under the non-compete agreements, right? You can't just graduate from law school and take the clients of the law firm you work for during your summer associate program or during your internship. That is likely to be litigated, but under the same idea of the non-compete prohibition, I would surmise that there would also be a similar it would be allowable to have a non-solicitation agreement, just like you can have a confidentiality agreement and a non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, and I think it really depends on how it's written, and the big issue in Virginia is why you need the restriction, and you have to tailor the restriction to what you're trying to protect, whether it's customer relationships or trade secrets or the like. So let's move to Maryland. And we don't have as many changes in Maryland, but at least one of them is very significant. Jack, why don't you talk about the prohibition on the use of wage history information?
Yeah, so this is an issue we've been tracking for quite a while, as more and more jurisdictions are prohibiting employers from asking employees asking applicants for employment about their salary history. And the idea behind that is that if you're setting an employee's compensation based on what their compensation was at the last job or the job before that, then you're really just entrenching systemic discrimination that may have happened, you know, to the employee coming out of college or something and sticks with them their entire career. So Maryland is now one of the increasing number of jurisdictions that is prohibiting employers from asking applicants about their salary history. The applicant can still voluntarily disclose their salary history if they think that would help them negotiate a better salary. But that's really the only situation in which the employer can rely on salary history in setting starting salary. Another interesting wrinkle of the law is that an applicant for employment can now ask the employer for the salary range of the position they're applying to. So that gives employees a little more information and a little more leverage in negotiating their starting salaries because they can find out what other people in the position are making.
And all of these changes, it's my hope that most of you, I know many of you that are on the line, and it's my hope that you've already adapted to these wage history inquiries, but that is, you know, what Jack pointed out with the request for the salary range. That's been included in some of the other jurisdictions. It's a pretty rare provision. So, you know, whenever you have a change like that, you need to identify mechanisms for how you're going to comply, you know, forms and what information we can provide. You don't want to be scrambling at the last minute with, you know, a recruiter potentially, you know, handing out a salary range information for the position. So that's a piece of this that is very important. If you've already adopted the requirements of the various states and stopped soliciting salary history information, that might be a new piece of this. You know, Jack mentioned that this is a kind of a phenomenon that's been rolling across the country. I had intended to include a heat map in here, but we now have 17 statewide bans and 20 local bans on requesting salary history information. They have a lot of, like Maryland, they have components that are similar. None are identical, but they're similar features. And then many of them do have unique features, so it's very important to understand, you know, what laws are triggered. And Jack, like my question for Tony, what happens if you're reaching out to an applicant in Maryland that has a restriction, but you're not in a state that has a restriction?
That's an interesting question. Historically, when dealing with the wage payment and other wage statutes, the Maryland courts have been pretty aggressive in extending Maryland's wage protection to employees who may be based most of the time in another state or the employer is based in another state, but they come into Maryland occasionally as part of their position. So in this case, the wage history law puts a ban on employers from asking about wage history, and an employer is defined as any person or corporation that is engaged in business in Maryland. So to use an example, if you're a company that's based in Tysons Corner, but you have clients in Maryland, or you do events in Maryland, or make sales into Maryland, or otherwise do business in Maryland, if you're interviewing someone who's in Maryland, then there's a good chance that you would be considered to be subject to this law, and would be prohibited from asking about salary history, even though Virginia does not yet have a corresponding prohibition. So whenever you're dealing with people in Maryland, you have to be kind of cautious because the Maryland courts are willing to reach out and apply Maryland's laws to employers who are out of state.
Judge Eiler's decision in the Maryland Court of Special Appeals still gives me shivers, where they have applied the very broad wage payment provisions in Maryland to a Virginia employee who attended 3 or 4 meetings in the state with clients. Maryland's very, as Jack mentioned, Maryland is very aggressive about enforcing its laws. And if you are in Virginia, it's becoming increasingly hard to hide from these state requirements. If you look at one of the heat maps on this, almost the entire East Coast now has them, with the exception of New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Virginia, as I mentioned, and then Florida. And basically the entire kind of East Coast and middle eastern portion of the country has adopted statewide prohibitions. And then on the Pacific Coast, Washington State, Oregon, and California have enacted them as well. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic. I've worked with a lot of employers on adopting to the salary history ban legislation. It's very counterintuitive. And this is what we've done for decades. You're interviewing someone, and because the pay that someone receives from a competitor is some indicator of their value and their experience, we ask them, what do you currently make in your current position? And it's been a standard question for many, many years. So it's important to adopt policies that comply with the various states in which you recruit and where your employees work. And it's not only ensuring the compliance of your own internal recruiters, but also external recruiters and such that are recruiting on your behalf. They could be considered to be agents who have violated the provision. It's also, I've advised clients that they should review their applicant screening and hiring policies, their job applications, and other hiring documents to make certain that they're compliant with the laws. In addition, I have, for some of my larger clients, they've adopted standardized interview questions and online screening questions to make certain that this issue is eradicated from the vocabulary of folks who are doing interviewers. And, Jack had mentioned that there's an exception in Maryland, as there is in a lot of jurisdictions, for voluntary disclosures. We've developed kind of protocols for documenting where there's been a voluntary disclosure so that it's captured, so we can make certain that there's no concern about relying upon that information or some allegation that we requested the information from the employee. We haven't seen a ton of litigation. I've seen some litigation on this issue, but I know that the Supreme Court is taking up some of these issues. Is that right, Jack?
Yeah, so there's currently a split among federal courts as to whether salary history can be used under the Equal Pay Act as a factor independent of the person's gender that would justify paying a salary differential. And the Ninth Circuit out in California is always on the forefront, as we know, of these issues, and recently ruled that an employer can essentially never consider salary history under the Equal Pay Act. That's currently before the Supreme Court. The court considered the petition this week, but didn't issue any ruling on it. So given the circuit split, there's at least a fair chance that the court might be interested in taking up this issue and making sure that there's a uniform standard nationwide. But in many parts of the country, employers are limited under the Equal Pay Act in terms of whether they can use salary history at all, or even if they are allowed to use it, the way they can use it and to what extent. This is an issue also that could be coming to Virginia, because the Virginia legislature considered a ban on salary history disclosures among the many employment law measures it took up this year, but it didn't enact it. I think we can expect that in next year's session, some of these measures that were not enacted this year may be revived, and with maybe less distractions on the employment law front, they may get a little more traction than they were able to get among all the changes this year.
So let's turn now, Tony, to the new Mini-WARN Act that's been adopted in Maryland.
So if you were operated in Maryland, or for us, we've advised people in Maryland for quite a while, when you do reductions generally, you have the Federal WARN Act, and then you have Maryland's Mini-WARN Act, which was voluntary, but effective October 1st of this year, employers who are closing or relocating a work operation from one workplace to another site, or closing down a workplace or a portion of a workplace that results in a reduction of employees by 25% of the workforce or 15 employees over a span of 3 months or a three-month period, then you are required to give employees 60 days notice of the closing or the reduction. Again, I was talking to one of the clients that I represent, and they're planning on doing a restructure that's going to result in these thresholds being met. First, we discussed the Federal WARN Act, but then upon further research, we realized that if this occurs after October, not only will you have to do the federal, but you always also have to give notice under the Maryland WARN Act. Now, the notice has to be given to all employees at the affected workplace. If you have a unionized workforce, then the exclusive representative of those bargaining unit employees has to be advised about the closure. Some part-time employees are included and who receives notice from the employer, and the dislocated worker unit at the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, DLLR as we like to affectionately call it, has to get notice of the reduction or the relocation. And then finally, elected officials need to be aware that you're closing and give them the same notice, the 60-day notice. The notice must include the name and the address of the workplace, where the reduction is going to occur, the name and a telephone number of a supervisory employee who will speak on behalf of the employer implementing the reduction, a statement explaining whether the reduction is going to be temporary or permanent, which is important, and the expected date when the reduction should begin. Now, currently, again, if you're in Maryland, you're planning a reduction or a closure or something of that nature, if it's going to occur before October 1st, you're fine. Just focus on the Federal WARN Act. But if you are planning something more long-term, which is going to be the end of the year or beginning of next year, you must comply with the Maryland's Mini WARN Act. And you have to understand that there are differences in the threshold between the Federal WARN Act and Maryland's WARN Act, which is a lower threshold. If you have 25% of your workforce or 15 employees that will be released over a three-month period, that is kind of it's a smaller threshold than the Federal WARN Act, which is like a third of the workforce is the number, and there are 100 employees is the threshold where you're covered by the Federal WARN Act. But it's important to be cognizant of both laws, because both laws will apply and be mandatory by October 1st, 2020.
And we have several, with a lot of employers that are quite sizable, that are with operations in Maryland. It seems like it almost might be routine for them to terminate 15 employees over a three-month period. Would you argue there has to be some kind of nexus between the terminations, like a facility closing or a reduction in force, as opposed to just random terminations for poor performance?
Exactly. So it has to be a reduction. Mm-hmm. And the Act, as you can see, the Act defines the reduction as the relocation of part of an employee's operation from one workplace to another, or just the closing down of the workplace. So if you're just releasing 15 employees, you may have other obligations depending how old those employees are under the Older Workers Benefits Protection Act. You might have other obligations if it's more like 20, 21 employees.
Right.
However, for the WARN Act purposes, if you're just releasing 15 employees that are not tied to a reduction, then you wouldn't fall under the WARN Act requirement.
Right.
But you might still fall under the Federal WARN Act, depending on the circumstances. So it's important just to be aware of it, but you're right, Connie, it's very specific when the WARN Act, Maryland's Mini WARN Act, is triggered.
Right. And employers have to be cognizant about this because, for instance, with a federal government contractor, if they are eliminating the last phase of work on a particular contract, or you lose the contract and 16 people are being reduced or eliminated, you wouldn't normally think about WARN Act obligations. Or if you're in construction and you shut down a particular site as you finish it up and you release the employees, this may be triggered under the new Maryland provision. So let's move on and talk about Maryland's hairstyle discrimination provision.
So this is also a very interesting development in that Maryland has added to the definition under Title 20, which is the Maryland equivalent of Title 7, the Fair Employment Practices Act for Maryland. It has included in its definition of race, traits associated with race, including hair texture, hairstyles, and protective hairstyles. So it expands the definition of race and makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of hairstyle. Now, there have been a lot of groups that have been advocating for this. As you know, like the most common examples are braids and dreadlocks, where you had a lot of women, actually, who were fighting to be able to express themselves or wear the hair that they wanted without discrimination. And Maryland has responded. For employers, it's important to be mindful that sometimes we'll have our own views of what's professional and what's appropriate or whatever the case may be. And we have to be careful not to discriminate on the basis of a hairstyle or texture, because essentially it's racial discrimination. We have to kind of change our mindset about how we think people should approach the workplace and how we think people look in the workplace, specifically when it comes to protective hairstyles. You might have be more traditional, and as times have changed, dreads have gotten more popular. Just an example, dreadlocks have gotten more popular just in everyday business. There's a time where it was, you know, we would associate dreadlocks with like Rastafarians or something like that. But now it's so prevalent that, and so prevalent now that we have this law that sees it as a protected characteristic, we have to be mindful that our policies and procedures and the way that we're carrying out our day-to-day culture at our workplaces takes into account the fact that these protective hairstyles are now protected class, and we need to be mindful of how we're responding to things that may not be comfortable for us, but now they are protected by the law. The other situation is there are certain industries where we need to have hair covered, like for food industries, for healthcare workers, where it's just necessary we have to wear a uniform, and you have to, for safety and health reasons, has nothing to do with the expression of the employee. So do we have to have a fine line between job-related restrictions on the wearing of hair and just arbitrary, broad prohibitions, which are now illegal?
It's a new mindset, and I think, you know, it's more than time that, you know, we're not allowing managers, decision makers to be, you know, kind of putting a discriminatory lens over their expectations for candidates or what people should look like or the like. And, you know, it's a benefit for everybody because, you know, your customers don't look all the same way, right? So, you know, we had these seismic changes in Virginia, but the next topic we're talking about is my favorite. Jack's going to be talking about face technologies.
Yeah, so this is a real cutting-edge topic. Some employers are starting to use facial recognition technologies and artificial intelligence in their interview process. One example that is pretty prominent is there was a company that would have applicants answer a set of three or four questions, just kind of generic questions like, what is your view of innovation, that the employer thought were important to its culture. And what the employer would do is run the videos through an artificial intelligence program that would then assess the person's facial reaction to the question, you know, whether they flared their nostrils or maintained eye contact, the tone of their voice, and that sort of thing, to determine, you know, how confident the person was, how much command they had over the subject matter, and ultimately whether they would be a good fit in the company. A lot of people find this type of encroaching artificial intelligence to be somewhat creepy, so Maryland has addressed that by requiring that applicants consent to the use of facial recognition technology in the interview process. So if you're an employer that is using facial recognition technology or considering it, you'll have to make sure that applicants execute the required consent. I think a bigger and more profound issue with facial recognition technology is kind of similar to what we just talked about with hairstyles, is the potential for implicit bias to seep into the hiring process. You know, you might have someone whose first language is not English, and they may hesitate before answering the interview question because they're just trying to ensure that they understand the question fully and that they're communicating their answer appropriately. It's possible that the artificial intelligence technology could misconstrue that hesitation as someone being deceitful or not confident or not really having full command of of what they're talking about. Similarly, you could have issues where, you know, certainly in Western culture, we value eye contact, but in many other cultures, there's not the same emphasis or they have different cultural norms. And finally, there are also potential disability issues if someone does have vision or hearing problems or a facial tic or some other type of condition that, you know, means that their facial expressions may be a little bit different than someone else's. So if you're considering using these technologies, even though it's not, even though the issue of implicit bias isn't directly addressed in the Maryland law, it's still very important to run that type of validation test and you know, consider the adverse impact that any biases that are baked into this technology may have on your interview process.
I like your creepiness, Dan. What happens if an employee refuses to consent but wants to proceed with an interview?
So the law does not explicitly address what happens if the employee does not consent. There's no real retaliation provision in it that that addresses, you know, that says you can't retaliate. But given, you know, the reasons why an employee may refuse to consent, you know, because perhaps they are concerned about, you know, a language issue or a cultural issue or a disability issue or some other protected characteristic, I would advise employers to proceed cautiously and take in refusing to consider an applicant solely on the basis that they didn't consent to the use of facial recognition.
Well, a very interesting development. So let's turn to DC, and we really just have one significant development, a new law going into effect that's been around for a little while.
Yeah, so DC's universal paid leave has been on the books for several years now, but it's just finally going into effect on July 1st, 2020. Employers in DC probably know that the payroll tax that funds the universal paid leave went into effect previously, but now the employees will be entitled to take the actual leave. A lot of the heavy lifting on universal paid leave is going to be done by the DC city government, since the government is responsible for administering claims that employees make and determining the amount of benefits the employee is entitled to and ultimately paying out those benefits. So the employer has kind of a limited role as far as that process, but there are more resources available for employers to review on the DC Department of Employment Services website if anyone wants more information about the program. However, DC is a little bit unique in that it's on the forefront of a lot of leave laws. DC has the DC FMLA, which provides more generous benefits than is provided under federal law and also provides them to a greater group of employees. And it also has the accrued sick and safe leave statute. So it will be important for employers, even though they're not administering universal paid leave, to make sure that their policies are updated and all of these different types of leave between universal paid leave, DC FMLA, accrued sick and safe leave, and any PTO or paid leave that the employer is providing, making sure that those are all coordinated so that employees can't stack these different leave periods together and get periods that really extend beyond what the law provides them and what the employer may be comfortable giving. Employers can also use DC universal paid leave to subsidize their own paid leave. The universal paid leave pays out at a fraction of the employee's salary. So if you're an employer that's providing paid maternity or paternity leave or paid family leave, you can use the amounts that the DC government is paying to offset some of the amount that you're paying to the employee if you have the right policies in effect to do that.
So let me give you another kind of conflict of law hypothetical again, because DC is unique in having paid leave. What if you have an employee, and pre-COVID, she worked in Titans, but she lives in D.C., and she's been telecommuting since March, and she has a medical condition, needs to take leave that would qualify under universal paid leave. Would it potentially be available to her?
So there are really two sides to that analysis. The first one is from the employer's perspective. Employers are subject to universal paid leave if they pay unemployment tax in DC. So if you're just an employer that's typically only in Virginia and you're not paying the tax in DC, then you're not a covered employer. From the employee's perspective, they have to either spend 50% of their time or more in working in DC, or if they spend less than 50% in DC, if they don't spend 50% in any other jurisdiction, and they spend a substantial amount of time in DC. So that would be someone who, you know, maybe works from home part of the time and then goes to client sites in different states so that, you know, it doesn't quite reach a majority in any one place, but they're getting to 50% in DC. But that's something, you know, with employees potentially not working at the job site and now working, you know, at home or in another location, employers will have to consider where their workforce is located so they can make sure that they're paying the right taxes in each state and are also providing the right leave and following the right laws.
Right. It's a thorny issue with our, you know, new COVID reality, you know, that we need to be, you know, thinking about, you know, at what point if somebody is telecommuting exclusively, and maybe for the foreseeable future, whether additional laws are being triggered by them working within that state. And that's just one example of, you know, a whole slew of issues, paid leave and ASA leave and all of the other forms of leave that are available in the District of Columbia.
Yeah, well, we're seeing, you know, a lot of companies are seeing that remote work is more workable than they had thought, because now that everyone's been forced into working remotely, we're seeing companies like Facebook and Twitter and a lot of other tech companies saying, you know, well, we don't necessarily need to go back. That you can, if you want to keep working remotely,
right,
you can. That obviously brings that creates a lot of issues from an employment perspective. But one of those issues is making sure that now that your workforce is connected by an internet connection rather than a physical space, that you have a handle on what jurisdictions people are working from and you're complying with all of the applicable laws.
So, Tony, you had mentioned the different minimum wage laws, Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. Were there additional points you wanted to make about the D.C. Minimum Wage Act?
Nothing more substantive than we already discussed, but just to be mindful that it's July 1st, $15 an hour is the new minimum wage in D.C., $5 for tipped employees. Double check with your payroll, either your payroll department or the vendor you use to process your payroll, to make sure that you're compliant.
Right. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we wanted to circle back and talk about some laws in the three jurisdictions that are unique to COVID-19. And D.C., Tony, why don't you start off with D.C.?
So D.C. has developed the COVID-19 Response Emergency Act. Essentially is its version of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Again, all employers are subject to it, and it provides to employees the same amount of leave as available under DC FMLA. So you have 16 weeks of leave. This is paid leave, unlike DC FMLA, which is just job-protected leave. It's unpaid generally. And the reasons for the leave have to be tied to COVID. Okay, so you have to be subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine or an ordinance. You have to be advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine due to the symptoms. You have to exhibit the symptoms and be seeking a medical diagnosis from a healthcare provider. Things like of that nature. It's the same standard that's applicable under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. So DC is allowed for employees to take leave under this Response Emergency Act provision. Now, it's important to note that this law expires July 9th, 2020. So after that point, this bucket of leave won't be permitted for employees to take.
Unless it's extended
by the D.C. The council. They also passed the Supplemental Emergency Response Act, which applies to employers of between 50 and 499 employees. Under that, you get 2 weeks of paid leave in addition to the FFRCA. Now, remember, that this is a situation where you can stack the leave. So you get the 80 hours, and then you get the extended, if you have a child, extended 10 hours after that. Well, this situation, you get the 80 hours plus another 80 hours or 2 weeks of leave. So up to 160 hours you can get if you invoke the Families First Coronavirus Response Act on the federal and the Response Supplemental Emergency Amendment Act. So just be mindful of that. That expires in about a week. So June 15th, unless extended, it'll be expired. But for this week period, we still might possibly have spikes in COVID-19 cases and exposure. So be careful and be mindful that if somebody calls out and they want to take this leave, they're entitled to multiple forms of leave, at least for this period.
Right. And Jack, why don't you tell us about the Maryland law?
Yeah, Maryland has a pretty limited law that they've passed that permits for bulk unemployment claims in a reduction in force type situation. If more than 25 Maryland employees are going to be affected by a COVID-19 related layoff or shutdown, then the employer has to provide 48 hours notice to Maryland's DLLR of the reduction. So that's kind of another kind of paperwork requirement for employers in a reduction in force. It actually does have some benefit to employers because they only have to provide this information to DLLR once for the entire batch of employees rather than providing individual employee information about the termination. So it's designed to really streamline the process.
Great. And I can't emphasize enough the resources that we have available through our COVID-19 Resource Center. You know, pretty much anything you want to know as an employer about COVID-19 in jurisdictions all over the country is available there for you as a resource. We are working with companies on implementing all of these different requirements in terms of leave and you know, dealing with checking employees as they come into the workplace and have some great training resources that are available for free that can be made available to your employees. It's a challenging time, and you know, everybody's really come together to, you know, try to help out employers and employees dealing with this challenging situation. And we also provided to you, I should note, some written materials relating, providing a little more granular detail about certain of the developments in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. And I'm now going to turn the mic over to Emma, who's going to give you some closing information.
This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation and copy of the slides and materials will be emailed to all attendees and available on our website within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.